Welcome to this broadcast of the inaugural Tanner Lecture on Ethics, Citizenship, and Public Responsibility. I'm Grant Reher, host of the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, and director of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship, which hosted the lecture. The lecture was originally delivered in the Maxwell Auditorium on April 10th. You'll be hearing from former United States Senator, presidential candidate, and Basketball Hall of Famer Bill Bradley, who will later be joined in conversation by Maxwell School Dean Jim Steinberg. In the coming months, WRVO will present additional lectures from this series and will air the Campbell Institute's State of Democracy lectures as well as the Campbell debates. The Tanner Lecture Series asks, what does it mean to be an ethical citizen? What does the need for public responsibility demand from us, whether we work in the private or public sector, and whether we are entry-level employees or top leaders? The lectures provide a public forum for exploring these questions in provocative and challenging ways. They've been made possible by the vision and generous support of W. Lynn Tanner, an alumnus of the Maxwell School and the founder, CEO, and chairman of Tech Canada, a leadership development organization dedicated to accelerating the growth and development of outstanding 21st century leaders. In the following lecture, Senator Bradley wrestles with the questions of public responsibility and, for answers, draws on his new book, We Can All Do Better. He puts particular emphasis, both in diagnosis and cure, on the campaign finance system and advocates for all of us to work to change it. After 18 years in the U.S. Senate, Senator Bradley's post-politics career took him into radio broadcasting, television commentary, nonprofit management, and business. He's currently managing director of Allen & Company. For years, he's been a leading voice for civic engagement and public responsibility. And now, Senator Bill Bradley delivers the first Tanner Lecture on Ethics, Citizenship, and Public Responsibility.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, and it's particularly a pleasure to be the first Tanner Lecture. I think that the Tanners demonstrate by their generosity to this program how important it is to care about a university and to care about the kind of things that are brought to this university. I feel honored that I can be their first lecturer. So thank you very much for your life and for all of your work and the difference you've made in the lives of millions of people. Where should I begin? This is not a formal lecture, all right? This is not where get your notepad out and take the notes down. So maybe I ought to begin by telling you a story. You know, I used to make my living running around in draft arenas wearing short pants. And so maybe, you know, we didn't have the dome exactly, but we did all right. Anyway, I played with the New York Knicks, and it was about my third or fourth year, and we played the Boston Celtics back-to-back Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. And we lost both games to the Celtics. And the following week, I got a letter from a fan. And the letter said, Bradley, if you lose one more game to the Boston Celtics, I'm going to come to your house and kill your dog. And the guy signed his name. Joe Pell. I don't know, maybe because he signed his name. I wrote back to him. I said, Dear Joe Pell, look, we don't like to lose any more than you do. We're doing the best we can. And by the way, I don't own a dog. Well, you can guess what happened. About 3 weeks later, a UPS truck pulled up in front of our house, and the guy gets out of the UPS truck. He's carrying a big box. He puts the box down on our front steps, and my daughter looks at me and says, Dad, what is this box out there with a dog in it? And I look outside. There's the box. On the outside of the box is an envelope. On the outside of the envelope, it says, From Joe Pell. And I open an envelope, there's a note inside. The note says, Bradley, don't get too attached to this dog. Which I always thought was pretty good advice for a politician. You know, don't get too attached to your job because the people might have another thought. People ask me, what do I miss about not being actively involved in politics these days? And I really miss two things. One is I miss not doing public policy 24 hours a day. This is a great school of public policy. People who are here who are professors and certainly those students are privileged in a very fundamental way. And I think because of that reputation, you were able to attract Jim to come. But I miss that, and I try to fill that void by writing books like We Can All Do Better, which will be at your bookstore in about 3 weeks. And then I miss the people, quite frankly. I miss you know, their hopes, their fears, their dreams. I miss sharing that. And I try to fill that void by a radio program I have on Sirius XM satellite radio called American Voices, in which I interview people all over the country about their lives. And the interviews usually fall into two categories. One is I interview somebody who has an unusual job. So you hear about the dignity of work and what work means to people's lives, and everything from a groundskeeper at Fenway Park to a public health nurse in the Aleutian Islands. And I also interview somebody who's doing something special in their communities across the country. For example, I interviewed a guy who had shined shoes in the Pittsburgh Children's Hospital for 46 years. And out of every tip he received, he put a part of that into a fund to pay for poor kids' health care. And the day I interviewed him, he'd put over $100,000 into that fund. When I ran for president, I used to talk about the goodness of the American people, and that's what I meant, the shoeshine guy at the Pittsburgh Children's Hospital. And the reality is that there are communities across this country where that is a real fact, and there are millions of people. I did this show, I've done over 400, so I did about 30 or 40, and the people at Sirius came to me and said, what are you going to do when you run out of finding people like this? I said, I'm never going to run out of people. I will always find them, because that's what America's all about. So if we know that, we have to look at our politics today, and we say, why doesn't our politics reflect that all the time? And I think one of the reasons is that there's way too much money in politics today. That's the reality. I mean, when I ran for public office the first time in 1978 in New Jersey, I spent $1.65 million on my primary and general election combined. In 2000, the person that replaced me spent $63 million, 61 of which was his own. And so it's no mystery then why 37% of the Congress and Senate are millionaires as opposed to 9% of the total population. Now, how did that happen? And here we are in a presidential election where we have individuals giving $15 million. The guy that kept Gingrich in the race gave $15 million to his campaign. How did that happen? Well, you know, these things don't occur in a vacuum. And in this case, they occurred because of two Supreme Court rulings. 1972, Richard Nixon campaign, Watergate, raising money, cash in a bag, a lot of scandal, law passed, limiting the amount of money that somebody can spend in a campaign. Taken to the Supreme Court, 1976, Buckley-Valeo decision says, you cannot limit the amount someone can spend in his own or her own campaign because to do so limits free speech. And so the result is that you have the guy spending $63 million to get elected to the Senate in New Jersey, and you have 37% of the Congress who are millionaires. And so, I mean, that is one historical moment. The other historical moment, of course, happened in 2010. But before we get to 2010, let's go back in time. It's 1896. William McKinley's running. He has a great campaign manager. Campaign manager is Mark Hanna. Mark Hanna is the first major, mover and shaker, you know, cutting deals as a campaign manager. McKinley wins. 1900. Decided, well, I got to try to improve my image. He selects a young New York politician named Teddy Roosevelt as his vice presidential candidate. Teddy Roosevelt comes out of the progressive Republican tradition of New York State. And he is appalled by what he sees in the campaign. Because Mark Hanna goes to corporation after corporation and says, I want $3 million from you, I want $2 million for you. Why? They say, because we're going to pass laws to earn much more than that for you. And Teddy Roosevelt's appalled when he sees this. Well, as luck would have it, or tragedy, McKinley's assassinated, Teddy Roosevelt assumes the presidency. And in 1907, in his first full term, he passes a law, the Tillman Act, which says corporations may not contribute to political campaigns. And the result of that is, of course, corporations were prohibited. That was the law of the land until 2010. In 2010, the Supreme Court of the United States and Citizens United determined the following. You cannot prevent a corporation from spending any amount of money it wants to spend in a political campaign, because to do so would be to limit the corporation's right to free speech. Buckley Valeo, limit the individual's right to free speech. Why is that relevant? Because in 1886, in Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railroad, the Supreme Court determined that corporations were people. It was a lawsuit brought on due process grounds, and the Supreme Court, which is the robber baron court, said that a corporation is a person, and therefore you cannot limit a corporation's right to free speech. Now, the absurdity of this position should be obvious to everyone. I mean, I will believe a corporation is a person when a corporation gets married, right? Or better yet, goes to jail. And so the reality is that those are the two decisions that have created our current political climate, where money has such a dominant role in the process. And so you look out there and you say, well, is there anything we can do about it as a citizen? And there is an answer to this, like with everything. You know, today, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book is to give people hope about the future. To say, look, we've confronted problems before in this country, and we've overcome the problems. We've settled the continents. We've fought wars. We've dealt with the legacy of slavery. We've moved ourselves forward in many countless ways, and we can do it here again. But the people have to have a belief that our democratic process gives us the means to change direction in our country and to alter the role money plays in our lives. If you don't believe that, it's never going to happen. And in the internet age, as I said to a class earlier, apathy is not an option. So what can we do about it? Well, before I get to that, let me give you an example. This is a little bit abstract about the role of money in politics. Let me describe the financial industry in the United States, the role of money, and what's happened in the last decade. You know, we had a little problem in 08, 09, right? The world financial system almost crashed. Now, why did the world financial system almost crash? Devastating the lives of millions of people, their pension funds, jobs, their hope for the future. I really think that the problem rests with five public policy mistakes that were made. Greed, yes, certainly greed, but, you know, greed's part of the capitalist system, right? But you have to channel the greed, otherwise you have disaster. And because of five public policy mistakes, we had a disaster. What are they? First one, the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Law. Now, what is the Glass-Steagall Law? Well, as we know in capitalism, things are run in cycles. The 1920s was a time of great speculation, where banks took other people's money and took big risks and lost a lot of people's money, and a lot of the banks of America closed. The Congress looked at this and said, we want to separate a bank that collects money from depositors from a bank that makes risky investments. And so we'll create a commercial bank which takes deposits and has those deposits insured by the federal government. No more bank failures there. And then we'll have investment banks, which will be banks that will invest their own money, and each partner having joint and several liability, which means rather cautious investments. And that was the system. And if you were a good investment banker, you made good investments, you take some risk, but not too much risk. If you were a good commercial banker, you were kind of the core of your community, making loans for home building, for car purchases, for seed, et cetera, et cetera. That worked very well. And it worked well for a long time until the banks started to say, well, we need more power. We'd like to merge these two. And in 1999, the Glass-Steagall Law was repealed. And as a result, the 10 largest financial institutions in the United States went from having 10% of the financial assets in 1990 to having 75% of the assets in 2010. So I do not think you can separate the fact this repeal from what happened, because now banks could draw money in from depositors and take big risks. That's the first mistake. Second mistake, there is something called derivatives. Derivatives are the following. I will describe this as a daisy chain, so you will get a sense. You get a mortgage to a house. Bank puts together 1,000 mortgages and sells them to another financial institution as a mortgage-backed security. The bank no longer has any responsibility for whether the loan is repaid or whether it's a good loan. And then the second financial institution takes those 1,000 mortgage-backed securities and puts them into a collateral debt obligation. And the collateral debt obligation is then sold to another financial institution that then, and this is how bad it got, put 1,000 collateral debt obligations into a CDO squared and sold it to another financial institution. And, of course, when the music stopped, everything collapsed. How did that happen? Because in 1999, the Congress prohibited, specifically in law prohibited, any regulation of derivatives. So greed unchecked leads to disaster. Third mistake was that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were two quasi-government institutions that were established to buy loans, buy mortgages from banks, in so doing lower the cost of making a mortgage and make it more available to other people. Well, you know, if you're a president and you want to have a lot of people have homes, you can do one of two things. You can subsidize it directly, you can give them a tax benefit or whatever, but you have to spend money to do that. But in the early 90s, it became the idea, well, you can have it by simply encouraging Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to loosen up their standards and make loans to individuals who otherwise wouldn't meet the criteria, and the result is more people will own homes in America. Right. Until the music stops. Now, the fourth mistake is in 2003, not happy with this consolidation of economic power or non-regulation of derivatives, banks came to the SEC and asked to increase the leverage they had, which it was 10 times their capital, to 30 times their capital, which is what they did. And the result was, of course, that when the crash occurred, everything kind of fell down, crashed all around it. That was the fourth mistake. The fifth mistake is the Federal Reserve itself during this period. didn't follow the advice of the Federal Reserve Chairman in the 1950s, William McChesney Martin, who said that his role as the Chairman of the Federal Reserve is to remove the punch from the party. Instead, we fed it with almost zero interest rates. Now, those are five public policy mistakes that produced the current, that produced the crisis of 2008-2009. Now, what's the point of me giving you this history? To draw the connection that in 2009-2010, the financial industry contributed $318 million to politicians in Washington. From 1998 to 2010, the financial industry contributed $2 billion, $2 billion in contributions and lobbying in Washington. And so Fannie Mae, in that period, contributed $100 million, one institution. And so you look at this and you say, look, we're never going to be able to deal with our problems in this country. You try to pass, get deficit reduction. You try to do, you're blocked by this interest group or that interest group. There's an economist named Mansour Olson that I always admired. He passed away. He was at the University of Maryland. He used to say, you can in a democracy reach a point where the narrow interest immobilizes the process so it's incapable of doing what it must do to serve all the people. And I think that's where we are in this process. That's where we are. Now, so I would argue that the answer to this is pretty simple. And whenever problems have occurred in American democracy, there are always answers. And the answer to problems of democracy is more democracy. And just as in the late 19th century, you know, U.S. senators were selected by state legislatures and House members by the House, by people. Well, state legislatures were sending people that were hospitable to the interest, the railroad largely, and banking then. And the result was that the work of the people wasn't getting done. There started a movement that says we need a constitutional amendment that provides for direct election of senators, just like there is direct election of House members. They no longer have to be selected through corrupt state legislatures. And I think that that's that's what happened. So in our current circumstance, here's what I think is the remedy. You need to have a constitutional amendment that undoes Buckley-Bileo and Citizens United, that says specifically that the federal, state, and local government may limit the amount of money spent in a political campaign. Very simple. And then whatever that number is set by the Congress, say for running for Senate in New York State, public money will be appropriated for those campaigns. Once you do that, you take all of the special interest money, the $2 billion from the financial industry, the $318 million in the 2009, the $145 million from the healthcare industry to assure that they didn't have a public option in the healthcare bill, $75 million from the energy industry to assure you there was no energy bill. They're all gone. Those two reforms. Now, in the last, I'm going to wind up here because Jim wants to have another dialogue and some questions and get you involved. But in the last year, citizen involvement has taken two forms. One form was the Tea Party, right? The Tea Party had one objective, and that was one substantive objective. That was roll back government. And indeed, in 2010, it elected 43 members of the House of Representatives. Those 43 members, when John Boehner, the Speaker, and Barack Obama, the President, cut a deal for a $4 trillion deficit reduction package on a weekend, Boehner went back to his caucus and presented this to them, and the 43 Republicans said they wouldn't support it. and they killed it. And in the process, almost brought this great nation to the brink of bankruptcy. That's how fast things can change. People say things don't change in politics. The change of a small group of people well organized almost bankrupt the country. A second citizen involvement in this period was Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street had a very catchy slogan. We're the 99%, 1% of the wealthy, and we're the 99%. But no specific program, no agenda. In fact, some argued we shouldn't have an agenda, we should just point out inequality. And the result was they've had no impact on the political process. So I say, rather than an passionate movement with no objective, have a very specific objective, like getting money out of politics, and attract passion to it. And that then the only way that's going to happen is with citizen involvement. The only way that's going to happen is people in this room decide that their future is as much in jeopardy because of the role of money in politics that they're prepared to step up and make a difference in the life of their country. And to me, it's a major opportunity for every student in this school and for every citizen. And you know, if you don't do it, you're abdicating your responsibility. Now, you don't have to do this particular thing, but citizen involvement is absolutely critical to the functioning of a democracy. And if all you do is sit home at night and watch Fox with the yeah, back and forth, or CNN, or MSNBC, and that's you treat politics like a spectator sport. No, politics is not a spectator sport, and it's certainly not a vicarious experience. If you don't take the effort, and as I said earlier, in the internet age, apathy is not an answer. Is not an excuse. Then what can happen is that once again we can get control of our government, and our government can address the real problems people face in this country, and we can move on into the 21st century with the confidence that we can be in the 21st century what we were even more than we were in the 20th century. Thank you very much.
Senator Bradley will now be joined in conversation by Maxwell School of Citizenship Dean Jim Steinberg. Dean Steinberg begins the conversation.
As you can imagine, for this audience and this crowd, it's an incredibly important message, and one which I think many people here believe very passionately in. But I think we might begin the conversation by sort of exploring why this turns out to be such a hard challenge. We've reached the point now, if you look at the public discourse, the campaign debate, in which government is almost defined as equivalent to the problem, not the solution. You have candidates who make their principal claim to public support that they are far from Washington, that they're not in government, that they don't have anything to do with it. And it's not just among Republicans, right? You have, even going back to President Clinton, the era of big government is over. We were talking earlier today with Betty Sue about, you know, how almost unimaginable to talk about a great society it is now with the government in the forefront. How did we get to the point where government is seen as the problem? Are there problems with government that we need to address? And how important is it to restore a kind of more positive, constructive view about the role, not just of the federal government, obviously, but at all levels?
What would we be? I mean, everything from sewers to roads to the Federal Drug Administration to the Federal Aviation Administration to the FBI to the CIA to the Weather Bureau to monitoring earthquakes. I mean, that's government. So the people that say there shouldn't be government, I look at them and say, they're detached from reality. So I think that the only way that you counter the drift is to be very direct about what government provides for people and how it is the best collective expression of what the people desire, which is what democracy is supposed to be. At the same time, government is not without its own shortcomings. And therefore, in addition to campaign finance reform, you have to I mean, people say government reorganization. That's always sometimes an excuse for not doing something. You just reorganize the boxes. There has to be greater accountability. I think sometimes the public employee unions have too much control over the process. I think sometimes that computer systems at the federal level are archaic, to say the least. Look at 9/11. The FBI and the CIA didn't communicate with each other. They had different computer systems. So there are plenty of things we need to do to revitalize government for the 21st century, but let's not be under any illusion that we don't need government. I mean, the first progressive was Abraham Lincoln. Well, he created the Homestead Act, which said if you head west and you get land, you get 600 acres of land on your own. The government will give it to you. He financed the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. He financed the construction of land-grant colleges all across the Midwest and the West. So the idea that there is no government, so you have to confront that, and you have to be very direct in confronting it. And then you have to admit that there are certain things that have to change and that you have to be willing to spend the money to do it. Why doesn't the information systems of the federal government change? Because it would cost money. Nobody wants to put a price on it. But without that, we're going to be left in this environment of two forces. One being defensive about government, trying to appear like that doesn't really want government, and the other one being hostile to government, trying to eliminate government. Neither one of those is going to solve the longer-term problems that the country have to face.
When people get into these arguments, they say, yeah, all these programs are good, but the problem is that because of the great drains that government puts on the economy, it hurts our competitiveness, that what we really need to do is focus on sustaining growth, and that means we need to have fewer revenues, fewer taxes. That needs to be the strategy for the future. What's your response to that in terms of the impact of government on competitiveness, on the ability?
Well, as I alluded to, I think government provides the basis for economic growth. What if we don't? You want to have private roads? What about you want to fly in airplanes where there's no Federal Aviation Administration or air traffic controllers? I mean, the reality is that that's not a realistic alternative, I think.
And yet, and you obviously spend a lot of time with people who are the corporate leaders, the people in business, all of whom are making this argument, and it gives a certain credibility, right, to the public, who says, who are the people who are building these corporations, creating jobs? They say that this is the problem.
Well, I think that one of the things government has to do is it has to be more responsible in its own activities. I mean, you know, we do have a gigantic public debt. It gets bigger every day. $1.2 trillion this year alone, on top of all the rest. I saw an interesting statistic that if we ever got back to interest rates where they were for the 10 years prior to 2010, in 2014, the budget deficit would be $420 billion higher. So we have to get control of the budget deficit. And when you do that, you have to understand the difference between the structural budget and the cyclical budget. The structural budget is the path of spending under current law, say for Medicare or for Social Security. And the gap between the revenues and that spending is the structural deficit. The cyclical deficit is the deficit that's caused because of the financial crisis, and now unemployment is 9%, or 22 million people looking for jobs and can't find jobs. They're drawing unemployment compensation, which means drawing down, increasing the debt. They're not paying taxes, which means increasing the debt. And in some cases, that means you need to spend money there in order to get people back to work. For example, I think one of the things that this country desperately needs is a massive infrastructure program. I mean, I saw one study recently that says, you know, we can create a 1.2, over a six-year period, if we spend $1.2 trillion on infrastructure, it would generate 5 million jobs. 5 million jobs. People say, well, how do we have the money to do that? We're so far in debt. That's true. But if we address the big-ticket items, which are defense, Social Security, Medicare, and other entitlements, if we address those and we put taxes in the equation, in other words, we get our deficits showed trending down over time, not this year or next year, because we're in a, still in a recession and unemployment's still a problem, but 2-3 years out, then that would create some opportunity to spend money on things like infrastructure. And then, of course, we take it to the international domain, and you're the expert on this. But, you know, where have we financed our budget deficits? Our largest creditor is China. It's like $1.45 trillion that they have lent us, that they buy treasury bonds from us. If we get our deficit under control, we need less Chinese capital for the federal government's deficit. But the Chinese are still going to have a lot of dollars because they're selling exports. So we then say to the Chinese, why, we'd like you to buy our special Build America infrastructure bonds. Pretty good investment for you over a long time. And therefore, the Chinese in the 21st century become what the British were in the 19th century, which is financing the construction of infrastructure that lays the groundwork for economic growth in the United States for generations to come. So you have to be responsible about the budget deficit. Then you would have less of a problem with the charges about government. If you're totally irresponsible, you will always have a problem. But let's make no mistake about it. 55% of the budget comes from taking from one group of Americans and giving it to the elderly or giving it to this group or that group. Not all 55% to the elderly, but it's a big chunk of it. We'll never get this structural deficit under control, and we'll never be able to reclaim our birthright. You know, there's a ticking time bomb out there, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know whether it's 6 months, a year, 3 years, 2 years. At some point, if we continue to amass $1.2 trillion a year in debt on top of $5, $6, $8 trillion, somebody's not going to loan us money. And when they don't loan us money, we then have to raise interest rates. Interest rate puts it back into a recession. Unemployment skyrockets. We have a lower standard of living. So in answer to your question, yeah, government plays a central role, but government has to be responsible. And the best place that government can be responsible now is showing people how we can reduce the deficit. If you don't want any taxes, you're never going to get there. If you want only taxes, you're never going to get there. I mean, I saw one study that if you did an income tax to raise all the money you need to reduce the deficit, the top rate would be 88%, and the people who now pay 25% would be paying 63%. Not in the cards. Not in the cards. So you have to do both. You have to have some revenues, and you have to deal with the structural deficit at the same time.
So if I can, because it's too easy to not do it, is just a little bit more on the entitlement. So, and not just the substance, but you say Social Security is relatively easy, Medicare is harder. What would be the core of your approach? And also on the political vein, you're now looking at the demographics of the electorate in this country, getting older, the baby boom generation, which has been built around expectations about what's going to happen, who've seen their 401ks go down, so they don't have a lot of other safety net here, are now looking for it, and you're telling them, okay, you know, here's the safety net that you were planning on, here's what I'm going to do to it, and here's why you should still be for it, even though you're going to be the ones who lose.
I would say don't underestimate the patriotism of elderly Americans. In 1983, the Social Security Trust Fund was thought to be on the brink of bankruptcy. And there was a special commission, bipartisan established. I was then a first-term senator and didn't know how I was going to deal with this Social Security issue. It was thought to be the third rail. You touch it and you're dead. So what I did is I got a professor from Rutgers, and we did 12, 15 special town meetings around the country, around the state. We'd have a big blackboard. That was the days of blackboards. And he would put the numbers up there, and then we would say, okay, now we have to get this in balance. How do you all suggest we do this? And the assumption was the elderly would want it all to come from taxes and would want no cuts in benefits. And the assumption was the workers would like all cuts from the elderly, and none of them would want to have the retirement age raised. That was the assumption going in. I found that to be incorrect. I found the elderly were also parents, and they didn't want to have their children paying so much higher taxes. I found the children also were sons and daughters. They didn't want everything taken out of the elderly's benefits. And so the compromise was we did a little bit of each, and we raised the retirement age to 67 to be effective in about 4 or 5 years. That was in 1983. And so I think that it's a matter of politicians who have the courage to explain things to people and put it in a context of what's at stake, as I tried to say. If we don't get control of this, and 3 years from now nobody shows up at the bond market, everybody's standard of living is going to go down. And this is not a gigantic, you have all the interest groups, which again is related to money, who say, if you touch anything with Social Security, you're dead in politics. By the way, send me $15 so I can build my organization, right? And what you could do to solve the whole Social Security problem, the following. If you calculated cost of living based on how people actually spend as opposed to some artificial index, if you took 1% of the Social Security tax and applied it to all income, not just the up to whatever it is, $190,000 now, if you raised the retirement age to 70 in 2057, if you did those three things, Social Security would be solid for 75 years. There would be no problem. Does anybody ever explain that to you or to you? No, because it's thought to be the third rail. So there is no excuse from actually leveling with people. My view is people want politicians to put country ahead of party and tell them the truth. And if we did that, I think we'd not only be able to solve our problems, but we'd have a much better country. Now, another story. This can be done. 2010, I think it was, Esquire magazine asked Gary Hart and me, two Democrats, Jack Danforth and Bob Packwood, two Republicans, to sit in a room in New York. We were all people who have our own convictions. We did battle each of us for 15 or 20 years. Sit in a room and come up with a balanced budget by 2022. You know something? We did it. And we did it by touching everything. We had increased taxes, largely through a gasoline tax, but at the same time we increased the gasoline tax, phased in over 10 years. We required the production of more fuel-efficient cars, 50 miles a gallon, so that in 10 years you'd be spending less on gas than you are now. We said if you're a farmer making more than $500,000, you really not eligible for farm subsidies. We said you raise the Social Security age. We said a variety of other things on defense. We have a defense budget that reflects the realities of today as opposed to the Cold War. And we got to a budget deficit, to a balanced budget. Now, we weren't running for re-election, which is a big point. But at the same time, that offers a major opportunity. I think there is a major opportunity in this country. And the more both parties don't deal with the issues, the bigger the opportunity is. How many of you have heard of AmericansElect.org? Raise your hand. How many of you are delegates? Okay. For those of you that don't know, AmericansElect.org is the first internet nominating convention in the history of the United States. And there will begin April 15th a nominating convention. You go to the website, you register. You're a delegate. You can nominate anybody for president. There will be a series of votes. June 21st, there will be a nominee. And because of a court ruling that says Americans Elect is not a party but a process and therefore not subject to the campaign finance laws, enough money has been raised to get that candidate, whoever that is, on the ballot in 2012 in nearly all 50 states. I remember the Tea Party, how quickly things change. Now, I do not think that in this election, I don't know, but I doubt that this was going to have a big impact. It's a little bit, it's appearing right now to be a little bit like Field of Dreams, remember? If you build it, they will come, except they're building it, and I'm not sure anybody's going to come. But in 2014, if there's still an impasse in Congress, you could have a third party that has four very specific objectives: campaign finance reform, the things I was talking about, deficit reduction, very specific things, and run 50 seats since only 45 or 50 seats are competitive anyway. You run a candidate in all those, and in five Senate races, you get 30 seats and two Senate seats, and suddenly you're at the fulcrum of power, able to drive the process. The Congress becomes more like a parliamentary democracy. And the result is that maybe you shake things up.
Senator Bradley now takes questions from members of the audience who are keen to know more about the positions that he's just argued for, as well as his reflections on his career in sports and politics.
All right, so let's go to the audience. It's your chance to...
Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
You a Nick fan?
I am a Nick fan.
Okay. You like Bruce?
I'm from New Jersey, so I have to like Bruce. I had a question for you about the adjustment from becoming an NBA player to a politician. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced becoming a player in the NBA to becoming a politician? And also on the more humorous side, was it more difficult for you to average over 10 points a game for 8 straight years or become a United States Senator?
What was your first question?
Ignore the second one, but the first one was what were some of the biggest challenges for you from becoming...
Well, one of the things that you think about, there's similarity between being a professional athlete in America in the 1970s and being a U.S. senator in the 1980s. Every day you have to meet the press. It is a public profession. And there's a difference, though. I mean, when you're a basketball player, you have to wake up every morning and crawl on your knees to soak in a tub in order to walk, right? As a politician, the pressure is constant. And I remember I was in the Senate cloakroom one night, and I was watching one guy who was talking, another guy telling a joke, another guy writing something, another guy smoking, and I thought, this is not a lot different than the Nick locker room. It kind of calmed me and allowed me to, so I can adjust to this. I think being elected to the Senate was probably a harder job than averaging over 10 points a game. But people say, what was your biggest thrill? NBA championship twice or Senate election 3 times. And I say, well, my biggest honor was being elected to the Senate 3 times. But all that did was give me the opportunity to work 16 hours a day for 6 years to prove the people were not wrong. But when you win the NBA championship, your fists are in the air, your smile and your face aches, and your chills are going up and down the spine, you realize you're the best in the world for that year. That's the biggest thrill.
Thank you.
You speak about the need for a constitutional amendment. Is there any attempt being made to organize that at this time?
No.
Shouldn't there be?
Yes, I personally think so. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this in this new book, right? I actually said it in a book I wrote in 1996, and I took all kinds of holy hell from all the free speech people. I retreated to just public finance, but I don't think that's enough now. I think you need the constitutional amendment. And yes, it begins by this room. It's not a complicated subject. It begins by this room figuring out how you do that.
Hello. I'm a Japanese Maxwell student. I'm from Politicians Ward. I have a question about decision-making and a vision. Today, many of the Maxwell lecture speakers reads paper smoothly and using PowerPoint, they're showing evidences. But you didn't use it. You're watching people. You watch the people's response. You are a tall basketball player. Your eye positions are very high. And internet, Wikipedia said that your visual visual is very much wider than any other human beings. Yeah, so, yeah. So when you're making decisions, are you trying to overview whole the situation, grab from higher position with a wide vision, or you are trying to focus more specific point, or to the and to try to focus one point like a basketball free throw? Which way are you using?
Okay, I appreciate the analogy, but let me take it from there and say I think that I had some skills, but I clearly wasn't the greatest player, but I had great eyes, and I had the ability to see the whole court. And I think that's what you need in politics. You need to be able to see the whole court, which means how this guy's related to that guy, and if this one moves, that doesn't move, and this can happen, and that can happen, as opposed to think it's all deficit reduction. That's part of it, but that's not the only part of it. So you have to see the whole court. You have to be specific, but you have to be flexible enough to create. And if you do that, you succeed in basketball, and I think that that's the best kind of politician. If you often find this with certain politicians. They know one song, and they sing it over and over and over and over. If you ask them another question, they look like deers with a head in the headlights, i.e., what was his name, Senator, who was Bush's quail. What? I wasn't quite prepared for that question. So you have to see the whole court.
Okay, you're right. Yeah. Okay.
I'm having fun.
Go ahead.
Hassan Brady. I'm Davis Hall. I'm a student over at Whitman getting my MBA. I had two questions. Well, first of all was, you know, we have a lot of right now, I think, a lot of like the partisan fighting. I think the perfect example is what happened. I think the recent resignation, from Senator Olympia Stowe in Maine, you know, because we can't really get anything done. So how do you think we can really solve that in the next couple of years? And number two, what is the effect you think it's having as far as on the next generation of people my age that want to get into politics? So for example, like, you know, people in 1960, you know, with the election of Kennedy v. Nixon, you had people that grew up and said, I want to work in the government, I want to grow up and be president. So now people are saying they want to work on Wall Street, they want to work in corporations, and not necessarily everybody wants to grow up and want to be president of the United States. I think we can solve that.
Okay. I think that on your last question, the only way that we're going to create a collegial politics is if we have elected officials who understand what the stakes are and understand that in a process that requires compromise, you can't compromise unless you know your colleague. And unless you're willing to modify your position. How do we make that happen? What's the catalyst? I mean, there are times in American history when there were two irreconcilable views that were right before the Civil War comes to mind. But usually what happens is there's partisan battle and one side ultimately wins decisively. It's not pretty, but it happens. Or you find some enlightened individuals, and I still had hope for some Republicans in the lame duck session here to come over and do what's in the country's interest. Absent those two things, you then have a third force, a third party, and that's the opportunity for the congressional party if you have this continued paralysis, in my opinion.
Hi, I'm Bo Stewart, and I'm a freshman political science and policy studies major. My question is, what do you think of Paul Ryan's attempts to address entitlement spending in the country?
I think they're serious. I give him credit for being specific, and I think that there ought to be a serious negotiation with everything on the table, including his proposals. I don't agree with his proposals, but they should be on the table. and should be where his proposals on Medicare, Obama's proposals on Medicare, or a House counterpart. There should be taxes. There should be defense. There should be Social Security. If you don't have those four, you're simply not going to be able to get it done. I saw one thing said defense entitlements and interest on the debt by 2014 will be 76% of the budget. So you're not going to get the deficit down unless you deal with those issues. And I think he's made a contribution by putting forward something specific. He's taken all kinds of flack for it. He's going to be one of the subjects of the Democrat campaign this year, saying, you know, Republicans will do this because he put it out there. But I think he has moved the debate forward.
Well, thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks for listening to this broadcast of Bill Bradley delivering the inaugural Tanner Lecture on Ethics, Citizenship, and Public Responsibility. Keep an ear out for future lectures from the Maxwell School at Syracuse University, as well as debates in the Campbell Debate Series. This Tanner Lecture was organized by the Campbell Institute, and the broadcast was produced by Fred Vigent and Tom Fazio. I'm Grant Reher, host of the Campbell Conversations on WRVO.